From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The eye wall of Hurricane Florence came ashore near Wilmington Beach, North Carolina this morning. Widespread flooding's reported in many locations along the Carolina coast. Florence is moving so slowly, officials are concerned about massive amounts of rainfall along its path. We'll have the latest from reporters in North and South Carolina right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Hope you have a nice weekend in store. It's obviously going to be a very difficult one for folks along the Carolina coast. We're going to get to a couple of reporters very closely following the events there. You just heard, of course, from NPR News, some of the damage already being caused by Hurricane Florence. Later this hour, census figures show the U.S. with its highest foreign-born population since the great immigration waves at the turn of the 20th century. But the education and skill levels of recent arrivals far higher than those in the past, even those just a few years ago. Could the current wave reshape the country as much as the one 100-plus years ago? We'll take that up later this hour. But first, joining us to talk about the arrival of Hurricane Florence with the eye wall of the hurricane coming ashore at Wrightsville Beach, North Carolina, is Will Michaels, Daily News producer at NPR member station WUNC in Chapel Hill. Will, good to talk with you again. What's the latest in damage?
Larry, what we're hearing from Governor Roy Cooper this morning is one, power outages as the storm makes its way west inland. We have about 500,000 customers throughout the state without power at the moment. About 20,000 people in 157 shelters. I won't inundate you with too many numbers, but the damage is starting to become extensive in places like Wilmington, where the eye of the storm just passed over this morning. We're seeing pictures of downed trees, and storm surge and rain is really the top concern at the moment. In places like New Bern, which sits at the mouth of two rivers, we've already seen massive storm surge there. In fact, I'm looking at a tweet from the city of New Bern that they sent out this morning. It says, FEMA teams are here for swift water rescue. And then in all caps, we are coming to get you. You may need to move up to the second story or get to your attic, but we are coming to get you.
The Outer Banks of North Carolina were an area of significant concern. The eye came ashore south of there, just north of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And I'm curious about the Outer Banks. I'm looking right now on TV at Nag's Head, and I was looking earlier at Kill Devil Hills. It looks like the surge is not so high at this point. What's the latest you've got?
That's right. Well, you bring up a good point because the Outer Banks are now in that upper east quadrant of the storm, which is expected to be the worst. The storm surge isn't quite as bad there, but there are some protections. The main highway there, Highway 12, has a bunch of dunes to the east of it that are designed to protect it from storm surge. And for the most part, it has. But I'm hearing that on Hatteras Island in particular, Highway 12 is closed. There's overwash in three or four different villages on the Outer Banks. That is a huge tourist spot. It's a beautiful spot usually. It's not so much this weekend, but Highway 12 is closed on the Outer Banks, at least on Hatteras Island.
Will, what about all the people that were evacuated? Are they being accommodated in hotels in cities like Raleigh and elsewhere in the state?
They are. They're moving to places like Raleigh, to Winston-Salem. There is a shelter there that's further inland with about a capacity of about 1,000 people, but they are filling up very quickly. In fact, there are shelters as far west as Charlotte that are filling up already. As I mentioned, there are about 20,000 people there, but that number is likely to continue to go up throughout the day. And really, as you mentioned before, the storm is stalling over the southeastern coast of North Carolina. We're expecting rain to continue falling over the next day. I heard from the governor this morning that this is expected to be a 1,000-year rain event.
Wow. We're talking with Will Michaels, NPR member station WUNC at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's daily news producer there with the latest details. And the count that he's providing is, of course, those that are seeking the government-operated shelters. It doesn't really tell you all the people that are staying with friends or family members inland who are occupying hotels and motels as well. So massive numbers of people. Will, anything to add before I let you go? I know you're very busy today.
No, you're exactly right. And just to add to that, there are mandatory evacuations still in place along the North Carolina coast. And if you add all of the people who are under those mandatory evacuations, it's more like a million people.
Wow. All right. Well, thanks so much. Appreciate the update.
Sure thing.
Will Michaels, WUNC NPR member station, where he's daily news producer. Now joining us from Myrtle Beach, which is just south of where the eye of Hurricane Florence came ashore, is Gavin Jackson, public affairs reporter at South Carolina Public TV and Radio Broadcasting Network, SCE TV. Gavin, thank you for joining us again. Specifically, where are you in Myrtle?
I guess I'm kind of in the middle of Myrtle Beach. I'm on off of one of the main highways in a parking lot right now just because everything's a little dicey out there with the winds and the rain. There's a lot of debris on the ground. I've been driving around just kind of getting a scope of things. A lot of power's out, so a lot of lights are out. Earlier I was getting some video of a power crew that was actually chainsawing a tree that had fallen on some high-voltage lines. These weren't just your normal power lines, but this was a high-voltage, high-tension line. And they were doing this chainsawing and removing these limbs in 40, 50-mile-an-hour winds, I mean, with the rain. I mean,
wow.
It was something to see and unexpected because you wouldn't think that these crews would be out in this right now because of the conditions. And actually, we just got word from Myrtle Beach Police Department, Horry County, which is the county that Myrtle Beach is in, that they've actually pulled all their emergency crews, their police, their EMS, from the streets right now because conditions are so bad, and they're going to have to wait to respond to any 911 calls once conditions improve. So that's going to be quite a while, and that's what our governor even said yesterday during the press conference. And they've been saying leading up to this event that, you know, if you're going to stick around, if you have to be prepared to wait this out because it's going to be about 2 days worth of tropical storm force, hurricane force winds, plus rain, and then obviously expected flooding from the rivers that flow towards the coast.
Has there been any estimate of the percentage or raw numbers of coastal residents who declined to evacuate and are trying to ride this out?
You know, Larry, I don't know that part, but I do know that officials were saying yesterday that about 75 to 80% of people along the coast here in Myrtle Beach and in Horry County did evacuate. And it's also worth noting that we are kind of in the off season, even though officials like to say that, you know, there is really no off season anymore on Myrtle Beach. You know, we're out of that summertime rush. So this is a little bit of a different place right now. However, you know, September is still a great time to visit the coast in South Carolina. So there were people down here. There are people that live here. But I did talk to one guy earlier today along Ocean Boulevard who was even around here for Hurricane Hugo back in 89. And he even said this time around he was not taking any chances and decided to evacuate with his family.
I think I mentioned earlier this week, and I can't recall whether we were talking then, but I mentioned there was a newspaper, I don't remember if it was the Washington Post, rather, that had an article clearly, you know, just timed to the time of year about what a great time it was to visit Myrtle Beach because it's sort of on the shoulder season. And this was right below an article about preparations for Hurricane Florence. It was so ironic. It was gone a short time later, but as you say, you know, it's not as busy as the summer, of course, but still beautiful place to visit this time of year.
Yeah, and on top of that fact, you know, Horry County, like a lot of counties, especially in the coast and South Carolina, have seen increases in population from retirees, from people coming from the north to the south. I have family that's actually relocated to Charleston, South Carolina, because of that. And, you know, we've seen this population growth. So to see that kind of evacuation and to see really no one driving around right now and to see that people actually took these precautions for what they were is actually kind of encouraging. And officials are also saying that they're pretty pleased with what they've been seeing so far. But it's also worth noting that just driving around, you know, there are no gas stations open. There are no restaurants open. You know, there's nothing to do for people. Even if they want to gawk, you know, you have to have your own supplies because, you know, luckily I have additional gasoline. But if you don't have these supplies, there's really no point in you getting out and wasting your time.
Do you have any updates, Gavin, on environmental concerns? We had heard earlier about industrial facilities where serious flooding could create problems, industrial farms, things like that, which would be inland somewhat, but still, given the wallop of this hurricane, could be at risk. Anything about that?
You know, I haven't heard anything directly about that. I know that we do have some nuclear power plants in the state of South Carolina, but the governor did address that. That's a federal oversight issue that they're taking care of. And, you know, again, they do secure a lot of these facilities. A lot of those facilities are rated for such conditions. But, you know, we did have Hurricane Matthew, and we've had some other incidents over the years, and we haven't seen any major environmental concerns, like from chemical plants or other sort of manufacturing plants, which we do have a number of in South Carolina. But so far, when you're talking about environmental impact, right now it's just, I think, a lot of farmers worried about the crops, because we have seen hurricanes in the past really do a number on our crops in South Carolina.
I'll bet. Just before I let you go to get back to your local listeners and viewers there, Charleston, the historic town there, right along the coast, an exposed low-lying town. Any word from Charleston, what it's experiencing?
You know, yeah, we are about 100 miles north of Charleston right now, and according to the track, this hurricane is supposed to kind of go inland before it even gets down there. I think they're getting some rain right now. I haven't been keeping up too much with their conditions, but a lot of people also evacuated from Charleston, too, just because, like I think we last talked, Charleston can flood on a sunny day with the wrong kind of high tide, and in these conditions, if high tide coincides with some of this heavy rainfall that's expected down there, it's a 1-2 punch for them that could really flood them out. So I think people down there know where their flood areas are, and if they don't want to take a chance this time around, then they're probably evacuating, because they've seen what can happen in these conditions.
Gavin, thanks so much. I can't imagine how busy you are today, but really appreciate your keeping our Southern California listeners up to date. So many of us have friends and family members we're concerned about there. Thank you very much.
Sure thing. Thanks, Larry.
Gavin Jackson joining us from South Carolina Public TV and Radio SCE-TV, where he reports. We'll, of course, have continuing coverage throughout the day. Hedy Lynn Hurdies is going to be paying attention to this with any updates, NPR hourly news, and, of course, All Things Considered with Nick Roman this afternoon with the latest. We're in for a couple of days of what's predicted to be extremely heavy historic levels of rain in some locations along the Carolina coast. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Yesterday, fascinating analysis of U.S. Census data shows that the United States now has the highest percentage of foreign-born residents since shortly after the turn of the 20th century. Now, back at the turn of that century, we saw massive immigration from Western European countries, part of Central Europe, people who were fleeing disastrous economic conditions or violence in their home countries. And that wave of immigration, or waves, if you call it that, because the different countries involved, had a significant effect on American culture and development of the U.S. Now we're looking at the latest wave of immigration being dominantly from Asian countries. And that's a shift just in recent years from when Latin America brought the most people to the United States. We're going to take a look at these numbers, what the cultural implications of them are, as well as just to look at how it stacks up historically with what this country went through at the turn of the 20th century. Joining us is historian from George Washington University, Tyler Anbender. He specializes in American politics and immigration and is the author of City of Dreams, the 400-year epic history of immigrant New York. And that's appropriate because, of course, New York was the epicenter of early 20th century immigration. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So first, give us a sense of how dramatically immigration at the turn of the 20th century affected American culture.
Well, it certainly affected American culture in the sense that you know, you got to, at that point, about 15% of the population of the United States was foreign born. And that changed, you know, the United States in a lot of ways. Americans started eating different kinds of foods. You know, Italian immigrants were the biggest immigrant group at the beginning of the 20th century. And at first, Americans looked at their food and said, ooh, disgusting, but eventually came to love pasta and then pizza. One of the other big groups was Eastern European Jews, and they, of course, had a big influence on things, you know, as you know, in Southern California, like the film industry and so forth. So, you know, each wave of immigrants that comes to the United States, whether it's those groups at the beginning of the 20th century, the Irish in the mid-19th century, at first, native-born Americans are always a little worried about them, but eventually they tend to accept them.
We had other countries. Germany, of course, sent a large number of immigrants. Even England. My great-grandmother came just before the turn of the 20th century from England and married a farm boy from Michigan. So you had all kinds of different immigration that was occurring during that period. Now, in the latest figures that we see, these are 2017 census data, we see that immigrants from Asian countries have surpassed immigrants from Latin American countries. And so who are the newest immigrants and what's different about them than the groups that came previously?
Well, so the number one immigrant group these days is people from India. The number two group is China.
More from India than China. That surprises me.
Yeah, that's a very recent trend. That was in those, as you said, most recent census figures. And so with Asia, with India and China and the Philippines, one big change you're getting from the past is you have a lot more skilled immigrants coming to the United States than we did in the past. So a lot of those immigrants from India have university educations. They're often people with backgrounds in IT or in medicine. Same with immigrants from China. You have a lot of people coming with university backgrounds who are looking for better job opportunities. And then the number five country overall in immigration right now is the Philippines, and we get huge numbers of Filipino women coming to the United States and becoming nurses, filling the shortages in that area.
So, and home health care. It's hard to imagine what the home health care industry would be like without Filipinos coming to the United States to work.
Right. And then here I'm in Washington, D.C., and on the East Coast, you've got, you know, different immigrant groups filling those jobs. And so so the home health care, not so skilled but necessarily, but then some of these other groups definitely coming with more skills than, say, the average Italian or Irish immigrant came with before. And yet the American public tends not to know that. They tend to think of immigrants as the, you know, the unskilled day laborer waiting outside the Home Depot or something like that, when certainly there are immigrants like that, but that's not the whole story at all.
Well, and it's so interesting looking at these, and this is just a few years different. So if you go back to immigrants who came to the U.S. between 2000 and 2009, about 30% of those were college educated. 45% were college educated in this most recent group, and again with immigrants from Asian countries being dominant. Now, I'm presuming that overwhelmingly those that are coming from India, they are legally immigrating to the U.S. Is there any way at getting at what the percentage of those coming through legal means, work visas, student visas, and the like, versus those who came without documentation in earlier immigration?
The answer is we can get at that. It's complicated, and so what both the Census Bureau and other groups do is they do surveys where they go and they ask people when they arrived in the United States and whether they entered legally, and they don't take names obviously because they wouldn't get people to answer those questions if they did. And in that way, we get a sense of the proportion of each group that comes to the United States legally or illegally. And so what you find with immigrants from India, it's predominantly legal. With immigrants from China, there is a greater percentage of illegal immigration. And you know, it will vary from group to group. It's often you find very surprising numbers when you do this. For instance, there's a high number of illegal Irish immigrants in the United States, and we tend not to think about that.
Are those visa overstays largely?
All illegal immigration is primarily visa overstay. That's another myth, is that the predominant illegal immigrant is someone who, you know, is crossing where the president wants to build a wall. But by far, the vast majority of undocumented aliens are people who had visas, came to the United States, and did not leave when they were supposed to.
We're talking with historian George Washington University Tyler Anbinder, joining us to talk about these most recent U.S. Census data showing that now the largest number of people who are immigrating to the U.S. For residency overall, Asian countries, the predominant place people are coming from in recent years, now more than from Latin America. If you have questions about the trend or the significance of it, we're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. We're the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, gentleman who's joined us many times on the program, from the University of Southern California, a demographer, Professor Dowell Miles. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry.
So, Dowell, as you look at the census data, is there a way of getting at what we're seeing here in Southern California? And is it possible that immigration from Asian countries in Southern California has now surpassed Latin America?
Oh, yes. We have they backed up a dump truck full of data just two nights ago, and we're still trying to dig our way out of all that. I can give you the data for California as a whole.
Yeah.
Stunning. Actually, California actually lost foreign-born in total over the last year. A slight decline, but of the and Latin Americans declined by 135,000 people who were born in Latin America, which include Mexico, Central America, and below.
Mm-hmm.
Asians are the only area of really that's growing. 83,000 were added in the last year.
So how would that stack up over the past several years as our Asian American population has grown in Southern California? Is this a consistent growth, would you say, or are you seeing an increase?
I think the last few years have been consistent, but there was a big turning point with the Great Recession. That's when Mexican immigration totally shut down because the jobs disappeared in America, and they come for jobs, especially the low-skilled jobs in construction totally disappeared. 30% of those jobs were held by foreign-born. And so Mexican immigration really just hasn't recovered ever since the recession. And Asian keeps expanding in the meantime. They are generally better educated. They come for education, many of them, and then stay. And others move in with higher education. Also, I feel that it appears that from what I've experienced in the housing market is that the Asian buyers are able to pay more money and therefore compete better in our disastrous housing market. And the Mexican Americans, they know there's better jobs elsewhere and cheaper housing, and so they're spreading out across America.
Yeah, and I was going to say, you also have so many now communities of Latinos in the United States of significant size that, you know, didn't used to be there 20 years ago, for example. And so it gives people many more options who are coming from Spanish-speaking countries. We're talking with demographer Dowell Miles, University of Southern California. We'll continue by talking with the UCLA professor, Karen Umamoto, hear what she has to say about the increasing percentage of Asian immigrants to the United States. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Reminder that Film Week is coming up. We're going to hear what our critics have to say about A Simple Favor, Paul Feig's new film starring Anna Kendrick, White Boy Rick, which is loosely based on the story of a very young FBI undercover informant of the 1980s. Richie Merritt makes his debut on the big screen as White Boy Rick. Matthew McConaughey plays his father. And we'll hear about the sci-fi film The Predator, directed by Shane Black. It stars Olivia Munn and Boyd Holbrook. Those films films, and more coming up on Film Week in our second hour here on KPCC. Right now, we're talking about this new U.S. Census data, which shows the highest number of U.S. residents, or highest percentage, I should say, of U.S. residents who were foreign-born since shortly after the turn of the 20th century, which was a huge time for immigration to the United States, specifically from Europe. And now we see that the largest group of people who are immigrating to the U.S. are from Asian countries, as we just heard from George Washington University professor Tyler Anbinder. It is from India, the largest number, followed by China. And Latin American countries are behind that. So that's a flip in just the past few years. Also joining us from UCLA, director of the Asian American Studies Center. She's also professor of urban planning as well as Asian American Studies, Karen Umemoto. Thank you very much, professor, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your sense of what the cultural impact is going to be? And could it be as dramatic with so many immigrants from Asian countries, the U.S., as what we saw in this country at the turn of the 20th century?
I think it's a very exciting time in many ways. And as we learn from our historian and from history itself about what happened at the turn of the 20th century, there's a lot of diversity that comes with this kind of with large waves of immigration. And the impacts are vast on pop culture, art and media, food, as the gentleman earlier said, on cultural practices, religion, and many different kinds of technologies, as well as the built environment. So I think we're going to, and we already have begun to see a lot of these transformations. It was interesting to hear the story about how people thought had a negative reaction initially to Italian food. You could say the same for Japanese sushi, where now it's become, you know, part of mainstream America.
That's pretty funny to think of a negative reaction to sushi given its popularity today.
Exactly, exactly. But I think the point is, you know, there's going to be a lot of diversity. I mean, from China and India alone, you have so many different ethnic and religious groups that it's hard to, you know, kind of cast one homogeneous kind of statement about what the impacts will be. But I think there is a lot of diversity that comes with the new immigration that we're seeing from different parts of Asia, especially China and India and the Philippines. But I think there's a lot of economic diversity, too, that sometimes gets lost in this image of the crazy rich Asians, you know, kind of coming to the United States. That's really not true. It's a very bifurcated population economically, where you have many who are very poor and then some who are very wealthy. And I think those who are wealthier are more visible because they are able to shape the built environment and impact some of the, or be more visible in popular culture more so than those at the lower end of the income scale.
At the turn of the 20th century, you did have ethnic enclaves in this country, but sort of where a person came from within one generation started to be, you know, heavily diluted. Do you anticipate that that's going to happen here in the U.S. with people from India, from China, other countries in Asia?
I think it depends on the group and it depends on the economic class that people are coming from. Of course, there's a tendency for people to congregate around churches, places that sell ethnic foods, and people tend to then build ethnic institutions within their communities to build that you know, mutual support system and all of those things. I think the question is, how long do those ethnic enclaves remain vibrant, and what are the changing roles that these communities and enclaves serve for these populations? And I think we've seen that it's been different for different populations that have come before this time period, and some have dispersed broadly into American society, while others have remained strong, tight communities, especially those who continue to receive new immigration.
And it's fascinating to see how even family to family of immigrants, there are dramatic differences. And you know, you look at immigrants from Mexico to the United States. Some of them are very culturally Mexican and are very still, you know, very tied to the culture of the country they came from. Others are very, for lack of a better term, Americanized and maybe much less practicing what we think of as Mexican customs and are just, you know, much more assimilated. So, you know, a lot of it is not even where or when someone came, but individual differences.
Right. And I think there's a difference between cultural assimilation and economic assimilation. I think for those who have come after the 1965 immigration law that favored those with some capital, with professional backgrounds, I think there has been a lot more economic assimilation, although these groups still hit the what's called the glass ceiling. But I think in terms of cultural assimilation, I think there's been it's really varied. I think some communities have maintained a lot of the cultural practices, the cultural sensibilities, certain ways of knowing that harken back to their home countries and communities and even villages that remain alive today that really then enliven American culture as well.
I want to thank you all for being with us. That's UCLA Director of the Asian American Studies Center, Professor of Urban Planning and Asian American Studies, Karen Umamoto. Also, my thanks to Dal Myers, USC demographer, and Tyler Anbinder of George Washington University, author of Dreams, the 400-year epic history of immigrant New York. Coming up on Air Talk, a new artificial intelligence algorithm being used to try and determine who's at highest risk for suicide. Hospitals are starting to embrace this, but what are the potential downsides of that? We can imagine the benefits, of course, in identifying those who might be at risk of self-harm. But is there a flip side? We'll talk about it after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Film Week is coming right up here on 89.3 KPCC. We're going to get a report from our Film Week critic, Peter Rayner, who's at the Toronto International Film Festival. I think it's still North America's largest festival. Peter has seen a number of films. I think he was saying 4 to 5 a day. We'll talk with him about his favorite films. More than 300 movies shown at Toronto, but Peter's seen the biggies, and we'll find out about him. The question is, can artificial intelligence be a lifesaver? It's a question that researchers at Vanderbilt Medical Center and Florida State University are trying to answer. Last year, a team of researchers created an algorithm that could potentially identify suicide-prone individuals. So the machine learning formula used information like age, gender, diagnostic history, zip code, and prescriptions to assess if someone is at risk of suicide. The data scientists gathered over 5,000 electronic medical records of adult patients who had previously attempted suicide or harmed themselves. And the algorithm correctly predicted 84% of patients who would attempt suicide in the next week and was 80% accurate in predicting a suicide attempt within the next 2 years. The question is, how would that compare with a human analysis? And what are the potential downsides of using a formula like this to determine someone's risk of self-harm or suicide? With us from Vanderbilt University Medical Center, assistant professor and lead data scientist of this prediction effort, Dr. Colin Walsh. Dr. Walsh, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So share with us how you chose the inputs to this. For example, zip code. How could that be helpful in identifying someone at risk of self-harm?
Absolutely. So we set out to use the types of data that is collected in routine healthcare encounters at hospitals like Vanderbilt, but it's not unique to Vanderbilt. And we really set out first by trying to learn about the space of suicide research and the decades of great work that's been done in suicide studies to understand what are the known risk factors. And we partnered, you know, our partners on this collaboration are our mental health specialists, suicide researchers, psychologists. And we sat down with them to say, what are the types of risk factors we'd want to include to potentially give to an algorithm to try to differentiate patterns of risk? We took those risk factors, and then we balanced that against the power of computational algorithms, which is to be able to process large amounts of complex data all at once. So we knew that past diagnoses would be important, but we didn't pick specific diagnoses to give to the algorithm. We gave the algorithm all the diagnoses that we could to allow it to actually come up with the patterns that led to risk. And so zip code is an example you mentioned. And we did one additional thing with zip code that I think is worth thinking about. We always are using surrogates, and I think it's important for us to acknowledge that. The variables to these algorithm truth, they're surrogates for that. Zip code was actually used to get sense of the area from which people were coming from. And what we actually did was we mapped that to something called area deprivation, which is an aggregate index of things like poverty levels, homeownership, various aspects describing the zip code themselves. And we know that doesn't describe the individual sitting in front of us, but it describes that environment. And we thought that that was an important risk factor to include in the algorithm.
Let me just interject. So I didn't realize that the area deprivation, as you put it, is correlated with a higher risk of self-harm or suicide.
It was an important predictor. Predictor in that.
But I guess I'm wondering, statistically in the real world, are certain zip codes, do they have higher rates of suicide attempts?
So I think what the way we think about it is that basically this is one part of a complex set of risk factors for every individual. So there will be individuals from a given zip code that will stay at low risk for their whole lives, and there will be individuals from another that may be seen at higher risk. But it's not the zip code alone that gets them there. It's a combination of risk factors. So for some individuals, you'll see one pattern, and for another individual, you'll see a separate pattern. So that's why it gets a little bit complex and why we've relied on these more sophisticated algorithms to get there.
And I apologize that I'm not understanding, but if zip code isn't a proxy for higher risk, I'm still not following how it's beneficial in being predictive.
Absolutely. So we don't think zip code alone is not necessarily the proxy, but zip code mapped to that index of socioeconomic status and the variables describing a zip code, census level variables, has ended up being predictive in both adults as well as other studies that we've done in this space.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Colin Walsh, Vanderbilt University Medical Center. If you have questions for our two guests about algorithm that is being refined to predict who's at risk of self-harm or suicide attempt, we're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Now, Dr. Walsh, have you compared this against a human professional analysis to determine whether a human is apt to get the prediction more accurate or less accurate than the algorithm?
Right. Great question. So we haven't done a direct comparison with this study. What we did do was combine what humans do best through our chart review. So our experts on that study that you mentioned from last year actually read every single one of those charts because we wanted to make sure that the codes that seemed to suggest a suicide attempt actually described one. And it turns out that at least at Vanderbilt, codes alone wouldn't describe a suicide attempt 42% of the time, which is a really big number. And so we relied on our human experts to really help us find that signal. We haven't done a direct comparison of our algorithm against the human's decision-making directly, but what we are planning to do as we're implementing our algorithms at Vanderbilt is leading into something called a pragmatic trial, which actually allows us to compare things like the insights derived from algorithms to the insights that might be derived from more traditional face-to-face screening, and then from other types of routine standard of care. So our goal here is not to replace the great work that people are doing every day, but really to add to a broader suicide prevention effort by making it a little bit easier to identify those who are at risk.
Dr. Colin Walsh, Vanderbilt University Medical Center, with us on Air Talk. Also joining us, professor of psychology at Harvard University, where he researches suicide and self-harm, Matthew K. Nock. Professor Nock, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Are you concerned at all as someone, you know, on the clinical side of this, that identifying someone through an algorithm is at higher risk of self-harm or suicide attempt, that it might be suggestive in any way?
Yes, but full disclosure, our research team is also doing work using algorithms like this to predict suicidal behavior from medical records. So I do have concerns, and I'm a researcher and a clinician. from the research side, I think this is, as Dr. Walsh suggested, a really valuable approach. But from the clinical side, it does raise some ethical questions. You know, is it okay for us to be running analyses, creating algorithms that can identify patients at risk without patients knowing that we're doing this? Is this an okay thing to be doing? Also, on the receiving end, what do we do with the information once we have it? If we have a risk score that says this patient, Mr. Smith, Mrs. Smith, has a 90% probability of trying to kill him or herself in the next week, what do we do with that? Do we tell the clinician? If so, how? Do we tell the patient? If so, how? And one complicating wrinkle here is, although we've got pretty good accuracy across, and there's about a dozen studies now showing this, that we have overall about an 80, 85% accuracy, as you said, the vast majority of our hits are false positives. So all of these models are very likely to turn out people as being at risk who'd never go on to die by suicide.
And as we come back, I want to ask you about what we're looking at, a percentage of false positives, because that's a very important point. If 84% accuracy rate, that doesn't necessarily tell you about all the false positives, as you just said. We'll continue with Professor Matthew Nock at Harvard, Dr. Colin Walsh, Vanderbilt University Med Center. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. If you have questions about algorithms that are being researched to better predict those at greater risk of hurting themselves, call us at 866-893-5722. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about research into better determining who's at risk of suicide or self-harm. That way, professionals can intercede, perhaps even family members, to get help for someone who is at risk. We're talking with Dr. Colin G. Walsh of Vanderbilt University Medical Center, where he's the lead data scientist on their suicide risk prediction effort. And we're talking with Matthew Nock, professor of psychology at Harvard, who's a researcher there as well as in clinical practice, talking about some of the developments there. So let me come back to you, Professor Nock. And so what is the range of false positives of these algorithms?
Yep, great question. It varies across models. Like I said, there have been over a dozen papers published now using over 100 different models. So this is a really hot area and one where there's a lot of great progress recently. So the answer to your question is going to vary depending on which paper you're looking at. But in general, you know, 70 to 80 to 90% of people we identify end up not being suicidal. So the models do pretty well. And we think about this without getting too much into the numbers or the prediction terms. You can think about this as looking for needles in a haystack, as we often think about, you know, the prediction of rare events like suicide attempts or suicide deaths or heart attacks. And these algorithms do a pretty good job of saying, here's a little stack that has a lot of the needles, but most of that stack is still hay. It's not needles. So we end up identifying a lot of the high-risk people, but a lot of the people we identify aren't really at high risk. And so that introduces a clinical challenge. What do we tell people they're at high risk? Is there a negative impact of telling someone who's really not at high risk that they are likely to have a high probability of making a suicide attempt?
Jessica in Hollywood called to ask about how does generational trauma, family history, how does it play into it, trauma in a family that might go back many generations. If you've got a family that you had Holocaust survivors, let's say, in it, or Jessica's interested in, you know, Native Americans who back in history particularly suffered horribly traumatic events. Dr. Walsh, does that factor into the algorithm?
So those types of risk factors we think are going to be really important. And I think there's a few arms of our work and work of centers really around the country, as Professor Nark mentioned, who are doing this, where we want to continue to think through novel risk factors and bring in things like past trauma, which we know are important from decades of research. We do want to help teach that to algorithms. The closest we are today, at least with our algorithms at Vanderbilt, finding things like post-traumatic stress disorders are there. Getting to things like family is a little tougher. And we want to kind of work on those efforts. But at the same time, we don't want to pursue perfect at the expense of good. So as the statistician George Box said in 1976, you know, all models are wrong, some are useful. So we're interested in really understanding whether these are clinically useful as we also in parallel try to improve our algorithms and bring in those risk factors like the ones that you mentioned.
And does race or ethnicity, nationality of someone, economic background, does that factor into the algorithm?
Those haven't been driving the performance of our algorithms. And I know there are other studies that are out there, but those have not actually been the driving factors for us.
And is that because those aren't necessarily proxies for self-harm or suicide attempts?
You know, it's a complex question. Partly, you know, you look at the types of data that you see at a place like Vanderbilt, you know, Nashville, Tennessee, and that might look different than a hospital that's in Boston, Massachusetts. And so those are differences there. And I don't think we've done the due diligence to really tease that apart based on just our study. I just know that for our study, there's been other factors that we've mentioned that have actually been much more important.
Matthew Nock, your thoughts about this and those factors, do you think they're beneficial to consider?
Yeah, they are, but they're really small pieces of the puzzle. One important thing to keep in mind with this kind of work is any given risk factor has a really small impact on a person's overall risk of suicide death. There's for suicide, it's clear based on decades of research, there is no specific gene. There is no silver bullet. There's no one factor that's going to do it. Our strongest risk factors show a little uptick in a person's risk. And what's valuable about this approach that Dr. Walsh and other groups are using is these algorithms take into account dozens, hundreds, in some cases of thousands of risk factors at a given time, put them all together, look at interactions among them to generate a risk score for a person. So we, with this approach, we're really not focusing on the predictive power of one factor, which clinicians often do, right? The human brain can only focus on so many and add into your model so many factors at a time. These models look at dozens and dozens and hundreds of factors and the impact of the collection of all of them together.
Dr. Walsh, once you identify someone as at a higher degree of risk for self-harm or suicide, what do you do then in practice with that patient? Let's say they're at Vanderbilt Medical Center. What do you do?
Right. Great question. So we're working through that right now with our multidisciplinary team. You know, it takes many types of experts and providers. You know, we've engaged ethicists, for example, to join us to help us understand the ethical potential consequences of this type of an approach. So, for example, you know, I speak to our psychiatric assessment service, who are the ones who are seeing at the front line in the emergency room, those people with overt suicidal thoughts. They're not worried about the person that's in the emergency room with them. They're worried about the folks who may not actually be showing up to the medical center as much, who may not have a relationship with, for example, an outpatient provider that they can reach out to when they're in times of crisis. So part of our effort at Vanderbilt we're exploring right now as we design this intervention is perhaps thinking through how does this type of approach help us with outreach? How does it help us reach those people who are not seeing or not in my office as a primary care doc or not in the emergency room to connect to those people who may be at risk and the algorithm helps us understand that, but then to pair that with an outreach effort to help find those people who we might miss otherwise.
Robert in Long Beach, wondering, using medical records, if that's true, is there any HIPAA violation possibility here, Dr. Walsh?
Right. And that question comes up so often. And so privacy, patient privacy is so important to protect here. And so one thing we emphasize again and again is that we're not using any data that is outside the context of an individual's medical record. And no data is leaving the Vanderbilt firewall and all the protections that we have at our hospital. And so one analogy I draw when that comes up is the idea of, for example, thinking through whether we start a cholesterol medication for someone with high cholesterol. You know, for years now, we've been taking a small number of risk factors, putting them together to generate a type of a risk score. We take that risk score and we turn to our patient. We don't just blindly prescribe a medicine, but we sit and we have a conversation with them. And that's all in the context of that clinical encounter. The analogy is the same here.
All right.
Able to look at more data at once.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. This is absolutely fascinating. Appreciate your talking about the studies in this area for algorithms to help determine who's at higher risk of suicide attempt or self-harm. That's Dr. Colin G. Walsh, Vanderbilt University Medical Center, and Matthew K. Nock, professor of psychology at Harvard, where he's both a researcher and in clinical practice. I want to take a moment before we get to Film Week, thank our terrific team, senior producer Fiona Ng, our AirTalk producers, Natalie Chudnovsky, Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, Carol Galli, Mary Knopf, and Julia Paskin helped us this week. Also, Itzi Quintanilla and Matt Bynum, our news apprentices. We thank them so much. Ethan Service, our great engineer. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. And of course, in case you missed the broadcast of the program, available as a podcast from your favorite podcast app. We're everywhere. And joining us this week, film critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of YouTube's What the Flick, Wade Major, film critic for Cinegods.com. We start with the mystery drama A Simple Favor from director Paul Feig. Stars Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively. Film about a mommy blogger who tries to uncover the truth behind her best friend Emily's sudden disappearance from their small town.
Stephanie, I need your help.
Are you okay?
I'm fine, but I do need just a simple favor. Can you come over?
Yeah. 5 days ago, Emily went missing.
A Simple Favor is based on a novel by Darcy Bell. Jessica Sharzer did the screen adaptation. Christy, what'd you think?
I love this movie. It's really fun and really stylish and sexy and darkly funny. And it is Paul Feig's impeccably detailed and stylish take on sort of a darkly funny film noir. So Anna Kendrick, as you mentioned, is a mommy blogger, a mommy vlogger more specifically, kind of a self-styled Martha Stewart. She has little recipes and how-to tips. And she's a single mom, and she's like perky, joiner, organized mom. And her son in first grade becomes friends with Blake Lively's son, and Blake Lively could not be more different. She is brash and she's profane, and she wants to get drunk in the middle of the day just to drown out the fact that she hates her life. And they become unlikely friends, and they bond over a series of afternoons. And then one day, Blake Lively's character says, "Would you mind picking up my son?" and never comes back. And it's how Anna Kendrick's character uses her organizational skills and her laser-like focus and her task-oriented nature to track down Blake Lively, who becomes more and more of an enigma the deeper that she digs. Henry Golding, who was so great in Crazy Rich Asians, is Blake Lively's husband, and the two share this beautiful minimalist mansion, and they seem to be happy, but they're not. And the more Anna Kendrick digs, the more she realizes she didn't know this person. And it's funny.
I was going to say, it sounds like there's plenty of humor opportunity
here. It is
here.
Paul Feig, yes, and so it's darkly funny, and it's sleek, and it's twisty, and I dug it. And of course, again, because it's Paul Feig, the clothes are impeccable. There's one scene where, like, a walk-in closet is a pivotal plot point. So I dug it. I had a good time.
Wade.
I like it better than I did 60 seconds ago. Christy makes a good case for it. I think it's the combination of the Paul Feig humor with the sort of the legacy of these kinds of thrillers that didn't quite work for me. And I that may be unfair to say that if you're going to make a Hitchcockian thriller, that it needs to be all the way Hitchcockian, that it can't have sort of those comedic edges. But I didn't feel like it ever really settled into a tone. So I wasn't, you know, you will have something that is very dark and very Hitchcockian, and then it will be followed by something that is kind of wacky in that Paul Feig way. And it kind of bounced around between those sensibilities and kept me a little bit off center in a way that I didn't, I wasn't comfortable. It owes a debt to a certain kind of thriller. Vertigo and Diabolique is even mentioned in it with a funny line where, "Are you diaboliquing me?" which I thought was cute. Gone Girl is another one from this kind of genre. You know, a number of De Palma films that go here. I kind of wanted something that was darker and less funny, I think.
Well, it is funny, but there's also a fundamental truth to it that kept me hanging on, because these two women are so beautifully drawn.
That's what kept me in it,
right.
were those two characters, especially Blake Lively, who I've never seen be this engaging.
She's great in The Town.
When you first meet her in this, she is, and those first few scenes are very diabolique, and that's what's cute about the line. There's a chemistry between the two of them, the way that they interact. It's almost a psychological battle, and that was really interesting to me. I just wish that it had sort of found a tone. I wish Paul Feig had been less Paul Feig-y. I wish he'd have taken more risks and sort of gone as dark as the material.
And for those
wanted.
Who don't recognize his name right off, he created Freaks and Geeks.
He was on Freaks and Geeks. He directed the last Ghostbusters, the all female Ghostbusters, The Heat, Bridesmaids was really what kind of pushed him over the top. Spy
is like this too, in that it's a combination of like darkly funny, but also a true example of a specific genre that he's trying to depict here. So So I liked it. It's fun.
All right. The movie is A Simple Favor. It's rated R, starring Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively. It's in wide release. Up next, the comedic drama White Boy Rick stars Matthew McConaughey and introduces Richie Merritt, the film directed by Yann Demange, based on the true story of drug trafficker and undercover FBI informant Richard Wershe Jr.
What you said your name was?
Brett.
Hey, White Boy Rick. You got some balls coming here like you did. You should come by the skating rink sometime. But not like this. But like you robbed a Kmart or something.
All right, White Boy Rick, a film that's in wide release. Christy, what'd you think?
So that clip and the trailer in general make White Boy Rick seem a lot more lively and a lot more infectious and a lot more darkly fun than it actually is. The movie's quite a drag, actually, and quite a slog. And in some ways that work, I mean, it's very atmospheric. It really digs into this very lived-in kind of grimy, gritty sense of, like, 80s Detroit and, you know, working class and criminal, struggling 80s Detroit. You really feel these characters and this setting that they're in. You can feel, like, the gross, slushy snow that's still stuck on the ground and the clothes. They have fun with the clothes and the cars mm-hmm. and the setting. But this really takes a long time to get going and to differentiate itself from any other kind of crime drama. Not until the very end do you find out why this story matters versus any other story of somebody who is up to his eyeballs in trouble, who then turns around and tries to be an informant, but is still caught in between. We've seen the story before. And Richie Merritt, who, as you mentioned, this is his first film. The story of how he was chosen to play this role is actually more interesting than the story the film is telling. He was just a Baltimore high school kid who had never acted before. And a casting director went to the principal's office of this high school, and there was Richie Merritt in trouble again. And the principal said, well, you're looking for someone to play this criminal role. Start with this kid here. And that's how he got the role. He's very authentic in it because of that, but there's also a stiffness to him. And he's extremely outmatched by somebody who is charismatic like Matthew McConaughey or like Bill Powley. And it really shows in a lot of the scenes that he's kind of in over his head there, performance-wise.
I mostly agree with that. I think that's really spot on. Well done, Christy.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah. This is one of those films where I found I was never bored. I was never unengaged. I certainly like Yann Demange as a director. His previous film was 71, about a British soldier trapped in during the Belfast uprisings. He has a grit to him. There's a grit to the film that's compelling. But why do I not like this as much as, say, something like Serpico? Why is it that I'm immersed in all this sludge, feeling the sort of post-apocalyptic despair of 1984 Detroit? And yet the story is not captivating me. And I think what Christy said about Richie Merritt being in over his head may be the essence of it, which is that these are some very, very talented actors here. I mean, Jennifer Jason Leigh and Matthew McConaughey, and people who really, really know how to take a muscular part and work the art direction and the costumes and everything and really bring the acting up to the atmospherics of the filmmaking. And I don't think he does. And because he is the center of the film, it's almost like there's a hole at the center of the film. And it's not that it's a bad performance, but it's just not up to the level of everything around it. So every time everyone else is in a scene, they're owning it. They're commanding it. There's energy. And then you come back to him where your empathy really needs to reside, and he just doesn't command it. And the film kind of falls flat in those moments.
Yeah, he's still a bit of a cipher. And then you have really an embarrassment of riches here with the supporting cast.
It's a tremendous cast.
Bruce Dern and Piper Laurie barely get anything to do.
And
that's frustrating.
And all of the gangster actors too, all those who are playing the crime circuits that of which he is a part, every single one of those is great, right down to the smallest supporting acts, his girlfriend, the mobster's wife. I mean, these are really, really good performances, even in small pieces.
We're talking about White Boy Rick. It's in general release, rated R. It's written by Andy Weiss, Logan Miller, and Noah Miller. Yann Demange is the director. The Predator is the latest installment of the popular action series from the late 1980s and early 90s. Boyd Holbrook, Trevante Rhodes, and Olivia Munn star in the film. It's directed by Shane Black.
And you men, someone or something tore them to pieces.
I think they're attempting hybridization. They're upgrading on every planet they visit.
Wade, how much does this Predator owe itself to the Schwarzenegger film?
Well, they are all part of a continuum. I kept wishing that a Predator would come down and kill this movie. That was what I was hoping for. This just got worse and worse and worse for me. Look, a lot of people do seem to like this. This is a franchise that has now been scattered across 30 years, four films, and they seem to keep trying to reinvent it in ways that they shouldn't. The original Predator was a very simple cat and mouse game. It was, you know, the most dangerous game given a kind of a science fiction twist. And the idea of the Predator is that it basically can camouflage itself. It can cloak itself and be invisible. And they are smart. The Predators here are almost never invisible. And when they're trying to be invisible, they're still visible. So everyone sees them and everyone is shooting at them. And the plot with this, you know, special forces guy who takes something from the Predator that you know it wants back, and then these two feuding Predators, and somehow global warming figures into this, and one of them wants to help humankind, and then there's genetic engineering, and then Jacob Tremblay plays the kid who you know, the son of the special forces guy, and then there's a truckload of other special forces guys who all have mental problems, and then they form a team, and all of this stuff somehow is supposed to make sense, and it really is just haphazard and all over the map. And they had to reshoot the entire last third of the film because audiences hated it so much originally.
Really?
And
wow.
I just felt like Shane Black was just phoning this one in. He's so much more talented than this.
He's done so many funny films.
This feels like a paycheck. It just feels like a paycheck.
All right. The Predator. What do you think, Christy?
I agree with all of that. It is just relentlessly noisy and repetitively so. And it's just empty. You know, there's not much to these characters. The one thing I do like about it is that, you know, Jacob Tremblay's character, he's a boy with Asperger's, and they use that as his superpower. And so he's actually the hero of this film in a lot of ways. And they approach that in a way that's never maudlin. You know, it's empowering. He's a wonderful young actor. He was great in Room, of course. So I like that element of it. But the rest of it is just noise and chaos. And there's some really weird, skeevy humor here.
Yeah.
In retrospect, knowing what we now know about one of the actors who was a registered sex offender, there are some scenes with Olivia Munn that are particularly uncomfortable now, given what we know happened during the production and the aftermath of the production. So it's hard to dismiss that when you're watching it now.
And just for those who hadn't followed that story, one of the actors in the film, we had about a 3-minute scene with Munn, is a registered sex offender. It pled guilty to sex-related charges with a minor and it served a 6-month sentence. Munn found out about that, complained to Fox, which is distributing the film. They removed that 3-minute scene. And the director, Shane Black, was friends with the actor that he cast for that small role. Black then released a statement apologizing for not disclosing this to the cast. The Predator is rated R. It's in wide release. It's co-written by Shane Black and Fred Decker. The Children Act stars Emma Thompson, Stanley Tucci, and Finn Whitehead. Richard Eyer is the director and Ian McEwan the screenwriter. Wade?
I really love this movie. It's so rare in what we do to see a movie that surprises you, where you don't know how it's going to end, you don't know how it's going to resolve, and where even those twists and turns along the way are surprising and yet not forced, where it's not meant to be just a screenplay trick, but where it really seems organic to the emotions of the characters. That's what I loved about this. This is a Richard Eyer, of course, great stage director, did movies like Notes on a Scandal, Iris. Emma Thompson plays a judge, British judge, who presides over family court and has to make some very tough decisions. And in this case, there's a teenage boy. He's 17. He's almost an adult. And it's a question of whether or not he will receive a blood transfusion to save his life because the family are Jehovah's Witnesses. Are his parents unduly influencing him? Is this his choice? And the way that that case develops, her relationship with the boy, which gets into an inappropriate place at a certain point, it never goes where you expect it to go. And then her marriage to Stanley Tucci is part of this. It's really a wonderful, wonderful study of ethics and love and romance and law all wrapped into one. It's a beautiful film.
Sounds like it. The Children Act at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. It's rated R. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. So many more movies for us to talk about. Plus, Peter Rayner checks in from the Toronto International Film Festival. Much more to come in 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. Our critics this week, Wade Major and Christy Lemire. Just want to let you know that Christy's podcast, What the Flick, can be found on her website, Christy with a Y, Lemire, LEMIRE.com. Also, film critic for RogerEbert.com. Next up, A Boy, A Girl, A Dream. The romantic drama stars Omari Hardwick and Megan Good. Kasim Basir is the director and co-screenwriter. Wade?
What a great surprise this film is. You know, Kasim Basir, this is his third feature film. Not really on my radar to any significant degree until this film. This all takes place during one night. And it's the story of a guy. He's a club promoter, played by Omari Hardwick, who meets this young woman, played by Megan Good. And it's kind of meet cute, and then they, you know, they're at a club together. He gets her in, and then there's a little bit of a bust up, and they eventually wind up in a cab together and spending the rest of the night together, learning about each other, wrestling with issues that they have, you know, being a little bit revealing, being a little bit vulnerable, then pulling back, and it's the evolution of a really fascinating relationship, all of which takes place on election night 2016. And that's the backdrop. You hear the election returns coming in on the radio. They go to a party where it's on the television and people are reacting to it. But it's never foregrounded any significant degree.
I'm thinking of like Shampoo with the
little
was
bit.
Was it 68?
It was.
Or 72?
It was.
Yeah.
And it's all shot as if it was one continuous camera shot. Now, I there are places where it clearly seems to have been stitched together. It would have been far too much to stage all of this, but it's still a remarkable feat of staging and filmmaking. And what's really beautiful about this, and I will not give anything away, but there's the moment where the film really gels for all the dialogue that goes on in this movie, all the talking that happens. There's a moment where Omari Hardwick and Megan Good deliver the best acting you have ever seen either of them do in a movie, and neither of them says a thing. It almost brings me to tears just even talking about it. It is so poignant. It is so powerful. It is so beautiful. This is a really poetic film, and I'm so grateful that it's out there. It's probably my pick of the week.
A Boy, A Girl, A Dream, Christy.
Yeah, Wade, while I was watching it, I realized pretty quickly why you love this movie. It's because it's low-budget La La Land. It is.
Yeah.
It's a young man and a young woman, and they have dreams that they have been too scared to chase for whatever reason, and they push each other to finally go after what they've always wanted. And it takes place against this backdrop of Los Angeles, parts of Los Angeles you don't usually see on film, you know, not famous places in LA. They don't burst into song ever, but they have this connection that's like romantic, but also rooted in the realism of the city. Yeah.
Wow.
Just
psychoanalyzed me live on radio. That's amazing.
It's beautiful.
You'll get her bill.
Yeah, please. It's beautifully crafted. Yeah. And the long tracking shots and the long pieces of dialogue, they make you hold your breath wondering how much longer can they pull this off. And it's really impressive. It's intimate but ambitious.
Yeah.
And it pulls off this really cool high wire act. They have amazing chemistry. They are both gorgeous and enormously photogenic, of course, but also they have really lovely chemistry with each other from the get-go. Yeah, I like this too. This is a wonderful small gem, a good LA movie. Go find it.
All right, A Boy, A Girl, A Dream. It's in select theaters, so check your local listings. Omari Hardwick, Megan Good star, Kasim Basir is the director and co-screenwriter with Samantha Tanner in her screenwriting debut. The movie is rated R. Unbroken, Path to Redemption, a biographical drama about Louis Zamperini. Samuel Caleb Hunt stars. David Sakure and Bobby Campo were in the cast. Harold Cronk directed, and the screenplay is from Richard Friedenberg and Ken Hicks. It's based on Laura Hillenbrand's book about Zamperini. Wade?
Yeah, this is a fascinating film, and not in a good way. This is ostensibly a sequel to the Angelina Jolie film, Unbroken, which deals only with the first part of the book, which is Zamperini's success as an athlete and then his captivity during World War II and being freed, and you know, he's a war hero. And this gets into everything that comes after that, which is very religious, which is essentially the tale of how his life, you know, he found the girl of his dreams. They they got married, and then he was one of these guys who was a wreck after the war, became an alcoholic, and then went to a religious revival at the urging of his wife, and that restored him to a person. He then became a man of faith and carried on in his life. And the film ends with with him being introduced at a revival by Billy Graham, which actual footage, which where he kind of told a little bit of this story as if to put an exclamation point on it and say this really happened. The problem is that this is what perhaps should have been part of the other film, at least in some way, has now been turned into a specialized, quote-unquote, faith-based movie that fits the exact formula of all of these faith-based movies, which it's always a professional golfer or a football player or a musician or somebody who drinks too much, is too rowdy, abuses their wife, their family. They find religion, their life turns around, the world is okay. That's the formula of every single one of these movies. And anyone who's seen these, if you've seen a dozen of these now, they're not entertaining. They are perhaps faith-affirming for people who are already predisposed to these movies, but they are not dramatic. They're not asking difficult questions and taking you on a difficult journey. And that's part of what made Zamperini's life fascinating. So you've divorced something that should have been part of the other story from it to make a separate story out of it. And I think that's unwise.
Well, it's also a challenge because Zamperini, from those I've known who heard him speak at churches, and because he was a regular fixture as a public speaker, loved what he had to say. Apparently, he's a very, very engaging speaker, and his story is great. It's very hard to capture that, as you say, dramatically in a film.
This should have been part of the other story. This is what pays off the other story in a very unconventional way. And I just find it's too bad that they couldn't figure out how to make it all part of one movie.
The movie's Unbroken, Path to Redemption, starring Samuel Caleb Hunt, Harold Cronk, the director. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. The biographical documentary Hal shows us the director Hal Ashby's life. A number of prominent people who worked with Ashby are featured in the film. Amy Scott makes her directorial debut. Christy?
This is a documentary about Hal Ashby. And if you know his work and you love his work,
Harold and Maude.
It's an amazing run in the 70s. Like these seven movies he made over the course of like nine movies in the 70s. Hugely influential films like Harold and Maude, Shampoo, Bound for Glory, Coming Home, Being There. I mean, it's an incredible run. And yet, for whatever reason, his name is not often enough mentioned in the same breath with the greats of that era, the Scorseses and the Coppolas of the world. He does not get mentioned in there. And this film tries to write that. And so if you love his work, you'll love it. If you're not that familiar with it, you'll learn a lot. It's an amazing array of people who were like, very happy to talk about working with Hal Ashby, from Jeff Bridges, John Voight, Jane Fonda, Norman Jewison, who was one of his best friends. And he comes across as this really fascinating, interesting, complicated figure. But I would have liked to have known more about his personal life. It sings his praises artistically and duly so. But, you know, there's a daughter from one of his five marriages. And we learn a little bit about that. But I would like to have delved more into the man.
I agree. It's 90 joyous minutes if you love Hal Ashby, and I really enjoyed this. Full disclosure, this film came across my radar 4 years ago when the filmmakers were trying to line up their interviews, and I know people who've worked on Hal Ashby movies, and a friend of mine and I, we tried to sort of hook them up with some of those interviews. They were not able to secure all the ones they probably could have and should have. Warren Beatty doesn't show up here. There are a lot of really significant figures from his films who just aren't interviewed, and that kind of leaves a hole here. At the same time, and they talk to other people like, you know, Alison Anders and Alexander Payne, filmmakers, to sort of contextualize the relevance of his work, which is a little bit, you know, pat. But what I love about this is that, you know, Hal Ashby was an editor first, and an editor for Norman Jewison. He won his Oscar for In the Heat of the Night, and they remained very close friends. And Norman Jewison is really the center of this film. He's the one that speaks for Hal in the absence of Hal, and it's wonderful how much he loves him, and you feel that. But I wanted more. I wanted, you know, it's 90 minutes and it blows by, and I wanted at least another half hour on those great films of the 70s. I wanted more on Bound for Glory. I wanted more on Being There. And I wanted a little bit more on the films of the 80s, which is where his career kind of ran aground, because there's a reason why it ran aground. You know,
why?
Because Hal Ashby was a product of the 60s. He was this guy who was a journeyman. He worked all these odd jobs, and he fell into the movie business, and it was his calling. and he found he would lock himself in the editing room and live there. And the movies were his muse, and he just found his calling in an almost existential way. That when we move into the 80s and it's no longer that Raging Bulls era of the 70s, when suddenly everything is much more corporatized and much more organized and you have to really obey the rules, that wild bull from the 60s was no longer able to fit into the system. And that's a fascinating comment on where we are now as we're facing another paradigm shift.
Well, and I'm curious, Wade and Christy, some of those movies were so different. And I'm thinking of, the adaptation of Being There, you mentioned Harold and Maude, of course. In the 80s, I question whether those movies could have even been made.
They would not have been made.
They could not have been, but maybe they could be now. And maybe they could have been since the 90s, since independent film, blossomed in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Maybe they could exist now. I want to mention also really fast, Amy Scott, who directed this, also edited it. She's a longtime editor, and it moves beautifully. It is cut so beautifully, which I think Hal Ashby, as an editor himself, would have very much appreciated.
We're talking about the documentary, Hal, from director Amy Scott. It's unrated. You can see it at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. Lizzie, a psychological thriller based on the Lizzie Borden family murders. Chloe Sevigny stars. Craig William McNeil, the director. Bryce Cass makes a screenwriting debut. Wade?
This is a very interesting take on it. It has an angle on the events in question that is unusual and certainly justifiable. May or may not have actually been what actually happened. But from a speculative standpoint, I found it interesting and compelling. But this is a very slow movie. It moves at a very slow, deliberate pace. So even though it's about Lizzie Borden and axe murders, do not expect this thing to move like Friday the 13th.
Yeah, it is sedate to a fault, and I appreciate the kind of languid, hypnotic sense of place it wants to give us, right? It's very rich in sense of place, and the connection between Chloe Sevigny and Kristen Stewart really slowly simmers and builds, and when it does blossom into full-blown romance, it absolutely works and crackles and makes sense. So maybe that's the point of having a slow burn like that, so that when things do happen, they explode. But yeah, it takes a long time to get there.
Does.
We were talking about the embarrassment of riches in White Boy Rick in the supporting cast. You definitely have that here as well in Lizzie, between Jamie Sheridan as Lizzie Borden's father and Dennis O'Hare as her uncle, who is just chilling and just terrifying from the first second you see him. But then you have Kim Dickens as her sister, who does not get much to do beyond just show up in period dress and be proper by comparison to Lizzie Borden, who was thinking for herself and was pushing the boundaries of what a woman is supposed to talk like and think like at this period in time. I found this frustrating.
All right. The movie is Lizzie, the crime thriller. It's at the ArcLight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. It stars Chloe Sevigny, Craig William McNeil, the director, Bryce Cass, the screenwriter. It's rated R. Coming up on Film Week, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the biographical music drama Blaze, which tells the story of the life of outlaw country music songwriter Blaze Foley. That, of course, the outlaw movement of the 1970s, really connected with Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, others who were not part of the corporate Nashville scene. We'll also hear about the horror thriller Mandy, starring Nicolas Cage, and The Land of Steady Habits, a comedic drama starring Ben Mendelsohn. And it's written and directed by Nicole Holofcener, who was just here at KPCC just a few days ago to visit. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We'll continue right after this. In just a few minutes on Film Week, critic Peter Rayner joins us from the Toronto International Film Festival. More than 300 films being exhibited there, and Peter's been seeing four a day or something like that. So we'll hear about his favorites. Right now, we're talking with our critics Wade Major and Christy Lemire, and many more films this week to discuss, including Blaze. Blaze Foley is the focus in this biopic starring Ben Dickey. Ethan Hawke is the director and co-screenwriter. Wade?
I love this movie. It's the first film of awards season that I feel like I've seen something that could really kind of breathe through the rest of the season and maybe win some awards. Ethan Hawke co-wrote and directed this. Tremendous job with both. He wrote it with Sybil Rosen, who wrote a memoir of her life with her then husband, Blaze Foley, who is a not on my radar, not someone I was familiar with, but a kind of a legendary folk country singer who inspired countless others, but never really reap the riches of his music, never really enjoy the success that he should have had. Ben Dickey, completely also off my radar, does an amazing job playing Blaze Foley. And Aaliyah Shawkat, as playing Sybil Rosen, is also equally wonderful. Chris Christopherson plays his father. It's very much like Bound for Glory, which we talked about, the Hal Ashby film, in that it's following, it's really an existential journey following this this singer-songwriter through what is effectively a song of a life. The life itself is a song. It has lyrics. It's represented poetically and given just this beautiful sheen. Even when they're living in abject poverty, it's poetic poverty. And it's like a ballad. The whole film unfolds like a ballad. It is beautiful to watch. It is deeply touching. It doesn't go where you expect it to go. And it is it has a really interesting structure, too. It's mostly told through narration or through kind of a flashback. Charlie Sexton, playing Townes Van Zandt, is doing a radio show and is telling the story of Blaze Foley, which just kind of comes up as a sidebar. And then the movie spins out of that. But it's a beautifully, beautifully written and directed film.
Number of songs have been written as tribute to Foley as well, notable in their own right. Foley's song, If I Could Only Fly, the hit for Merle Haggard, as well as for many other country stars, Election Day, so many other films, Fair and Square, that were compositions by Foley. The movie is Blaze. It's at the Arclight Hollywood in the Landmark West LA, rated R. The horror thriller Mandy stars Nicolas Cage. Panos Cosmatos is the director and the co-screenwriter. Christy?
If you enjoy insane, unhinged Nicolas Cage, this is the movie for you. This is the role he was born to play. I love this movie. It's so crazy. So I will try to explain it really fast. Nicolas Cage and Andrea Riseborough live this very idyllic life in the mountains and the forest in Oregon in 1983. Quiet, sedate, and then one day this LSD-fueled cult swoops in and abducts her because the guy who runs the cult has seen her on the street and determined, I need to have her. She's my crown jewel. I've got to have her. And so the drugged-up sycophants who follow him around swoop in. Some of them, because they had a bad batch of LSD, have been transformed into these like guar looking monsters, like bikers.
Orcs. They're orcs.
They're like heavy metal orcs on motorcycles.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's nuts.
This sounds like a must see.
It is lurid. It is colorful. The score is like synthy, and then sometimes it's like really intense guitars. It is every bit of 2 hours long. So if this is not your cup of tea, this is not going to be your cup of tea. But if you want to see Nicolas Cage like naked and crying and drinking on the toilet, this is that movie. I dug it.
Good to know. It's unrated. Now we know why. All right. Wade?
I so hate this movie with every fiber of my existence. Okay, so Panos Cosmatos is the son of George Cosmatos, most famous for directing Tombstone. So he's a second-generation filmmaker. His previous film was Beyond the Black Rainbow, which was also a completely bonkers, psychedelic trip through 60s weirdness, and everything in his movies is red and bright red and very psychedelic. I don't know what's going on in this movie. Christy, you did an amazing job describing it.
Thank you.
It's funny when it shouldn't be, and it's not funny when it should. It just, there's a scene here where Nick goes, when he's ready to go on his revenge rampage, he goes to get some weaponry from Bill Duke, and it's in a trailer. And the problem here is Bill Duke is under the impression that he's in a real movie, and Bill Duke is working so hard. He's acting. He's really acting. And then Nick loses his mind and does that out-of-control Nick Cage thing that he does. And there's a close-up, but I don't even know if this was intentional. But the look on Bill Duke's face is, I don't know how to act now. What's going on?
This
just went off the rails. I thought we were making, like, what are you doing? He just can't believe that. And Linus Roach should never be naked in a movie. No, don't do that.
You just inadvertently sold this thing, Wade. Everyone's going to want to go see it now.
Mandy from Panos Cosmatos, starring Nicolas Cage, Andrea Riseborough. The movie's unrated. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, the Harkins Cerritos, Harkins Chino Hills, and the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana. The comedic drama, The Land of Steady Habits, stars Ben Mendelsohn and Edie Falco, Connie Britton, Thomas Mann are in the cast, and it's written and directed by Nicole Holofcener. Wade?
I adore Nicole Holofcener. I think she's a wonderful writer and director. She makes movies about middle-class angst in a way that I've never seen done before, and they capture it in all of its darkness and its wonderfulness. Enough Said just brought me to tears. It's so beautiful. Please Give, Friends with Money, Walking and Talking. These are all amazing movies. I don't think this is the best film she's ever made, but I really like it a lot. Ben Mendelsohn, kind of a guy who broke up his family because of a midlife crisis and is still now sort of in the middle of his life trying to figure out what he wants to do when he grows up. And it gets into his relationship with his ex-wife, Edie Falco, who's moved on with his son. And it's just such an interesting look at these anxieties that I think are magnified now, perhaps more than they have been at any other time in the last 30 years. And it's thoughtful, and it's really smart, and it's really professional. It has some great performances, and I really liked it.
The Land of Steady Habits. What'd you think, Christy?
I'm not as fond of it. I am a big fan of Nicole Holofcener as well, and it's a tremendous cast. And she does have a wonderful knack for creating these, you know, fully fleshed out, lived in characters. I just wasn't particularly interested in Ben Mendelsohn's character. It's this weird celebration of, like, middle-aged white men behaving badly, you know? And I think she holds that up as, like, look how fascinating he is. But, like, he's a cliche. So what is interesting about him? Edie Falco can do no wrong. There are some unexpected moments where, you know, characters deviate and do the wrong thing, but the film never judges them for it. And that's kind of interesting. I wanted to like this more.
The Land of Steady Habits is unrated. It's streaming on Netflix. I Think We're Alone Now, sci-fi film starring Peter Dinklage and Elle Fanning. Reed Morano is the director, Mike Makowski the screenwriter. Christy?
So Reed Morano directed this, but she's also a cinematographer, so she also shot it. So it's got a really beautiful kind of dreamy look about it, even though this is, you know, in theory, a nightmare scenario. So apparently the world has ended or something. You know, there's nobody left in this small town in upstate New York except for Peter Dinklage, who goes house to house and street to street, cleaning each house and wrapping up the bodies and burying them and looking for batteries. And he goes about it very methodically. And these opening scenes are really fascinating just in the wordlessness of them, of the process, watching him. And it says so much about this man and what matters to him, the way he goes about doing it. He fishes. He enjoys a nice glass of wine. He enjoys the solitude of this place. But he thinks he's alone now, but he's not, because Elle Fanning shows up, and she apparently also has survived whatever has hit humanity, and it's how they kind of feel each other out. And very conveniently, he is stoic, and he is reticent, and she's like manic pixie dream girl, and she's chatty, and she wants to draw him out. And I guess they do kind of meet in the middle and begin to understand each other, and it's interesting as an exploration of humanity and isolation and solitude. And then it takes this really hard turn in the third act and becomes a totally different kind of paranoid piece of sci-fi, and it just does not work. What was interesting about the ambiguity of it gets massively over-explained. There's a lot of hand-holding, and I just felt like it was a missed opportunity.
I Think We're Alone Now, R-rated sci-fi drama. Peter Dinklage, Elle Fanning star, Reed Morano directed. It's at the ArcLight in Culver City. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we go north. Peter Rayner joining us from the Toronto International Film Festival. We'll hear Peter's favorites in just 1 minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Our Film Week critic and critic for the Christian Science Monitor, Peter Rayner, is at the Toronto International Film Festival. Hundreds of films are being shown, and Peter seemingly is seeing many of them, if not all. Peter, great to have you with us today.
Thanks, Larry. I'm taking time off from my 38th movie to talk to you now.
38 films so far. Well, let's start with a film that at Telluride got raves. We heard last week from Claudia Puig and John Horn as they extolled Roma, the film written and directed by Alfonso Cuarón. You've seen it now. What'd you think?
Yeah, it's. I don't think it's quite a towering masterpiece, but I think it's a marvelous movie that is the best film I've seen here at the festival. Alfonso Cuarón, very semi-autobiographical, all done in black and white. It reminded me, in its best moments, of some of the De Sica films like Umberto D and Bicycle Thief, the sort of neorealism.
Well, and you're the first critic who brought Cuarón to my attention way back with The Little Princess.
Yeah, I really championed that movie, and now I'm looking for my 10% on the Harry Potter film that he directed that got him going. Yeah, he really is incredibly versatile. He's Gravity, Y Tu Mamá También, Little Princess, this film, Harry Potter. You know, he's all over the place, and he's good in all of them.
First Man, which tells the story of Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon, Ryan Gosling stars, Jamie and Chazelle of La La Land, the director of the film. What'd you think of that?
I think it's terrific when it's in outer space. When it's on the ground, I think it's a little more mundane. I think the problem for me with the movie is that they're trying to demystify, de-heroicize Neil Armstrong to such an extent that Ryan Gosling comes across a little bit catatonic almost in the way that he portrays the character. Neil Armstrong's two sons were there, and they're big supporters of the film. I don't think it's just for financial reasons. One of them kind of said, they got Dad right, and if they didn't, we wouldn't be here. So that's
all right.
The source.
First Man is going to open in theaters the middle of next month. Roma, I neglected to say, opens in mid-December theatrically and streaming on Netflix. The James Baldwin novel, If Beale Street Could Talk, has been adapted by Barry Jenkins. Moonlight, of course, his Oscar-winning film. If Beale Street Could Talk stars Kiki Layne and Stephan James. What do you think, Peter, of If Beale Street Could Talk?
As with most of the high-profile films here, I was sort of mixed. It was, highly anticipated as a sequel to, not the sequel, the follow-up to Moonlight. And it has the same sort of pluses and minuses for me as that movie. I think that Jenkins is essentially a director of moods more than, action or drama or narrative or even character. He just sort of likes to hold things very still. And I think, in a way, it sort of etherealizes the experience and makes it, sort of float off into the ozone. But there are some powerful things in this film. It's strong material, and there are times when it has a sort of trance-like effect, which I thought also that Moonlight had.
If Beale Street Could Talk is releasing in late November, Fahrenheit 11-9, Michael Moore's new comedic documentary. What do you think of Moore's new effort, Peter?
Well, I always blow hot and cold with Michael Moore. I think his strongest stuff is really good, and then he usually undermines his best effects with something really, dopey. In this movie, a lot of people think this is sort of a full-scale attack on Trump, and it starts out that way. But then it moves into other areas for a while that are much more interesting, dealing with the water pollution crisis ongoing in Flint, Michigan. And there's some really terrific stuff that he does there showing, how corrupt the situation is there, with the Republican governor and even with Obama. This all started in Obama's administration. There's a great moment when Obama goes to Flint and says the water's okay to drink now, and then you see him supposedly take a drink of water in front of everybody, but he actually just barely touches it to his lips. So,
wow.
So I don't know where he gets this footage from. But then he also, he has like Hitler speaking in newsreels and with, Trump's verbiage coming out of his mouth, that kind of stuff, which, really doesn't do anybody any good, I think.
Fahrenheit 11-9, Michael Moore's new documentary comes out very soon, comes out this month in theaters. Monrovia, Indiana, the latest documentary from 88-year-old Frederick Wiseman, which takes us to this rural town to show what life is like. Peter, how is Wiseman's new film?
It's very good. It's not one of his very best, but it... usually he deals with specific institutions, you know, police force, you know, libraries, communities. This is a much, you know, larger community that he doesn't quite get inside of. The people, I think, there are a bit, you know, recessive in terms of what they yield up to the camera. But it's very moving in places. It's very strong. He has, you know, just a wonderful feeling for, I don't know how else to put it, the sacredness of people. He's the opposite. I saw this movie right after the Michael Moore movie.
Wow.
It was sort of like a palate cleanser because, you know, I mean, Fred Wiseman is the least coercive of directors, and that's to his credit.
Yeah, Monrovia, Indiana, the documentary, will be releasing the third week of October. The Sisters Brothers, comedic Western stars John C. Reilly, Joaquin Phoenix, and Jake Gyllenhaal. Jacques Audiard is the director and co-screenwriter. Peter?
Yeah, this is, you know, famed French director's American movie, and it's tries to be funny, it tries to be serious, it tries to be gruesome, it tries to be loopy. You know, it doesn't quite mix up all these tones in a way that seemed entirely programmed. It reminded me in some ways of that old Western Missouri Breaks, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And Jack Nicholson, which I sort of like, you know, and True Grit and some of these other films. But it has a terrific cast, you know, that you mentioned, you know, Riz Ahmed and you know, they're all very good in the movie. And even though I think it's a really mixed bag, it's certainly worth seeing. It's one of the odder Westerns in the canon.
The Sisters Brothers, directed and co-written by Jacques Audiard, and it's going to be released coming up very soon here in September. Peter is joining us from the Toronto International Film Festival. A Star is Born, the much-anticipated, what is this, the fourth version of it, Bradley Cooper?
Yeah, fourth version, right. People always forget the first one from the 30s.
But yeah. Yeah, was that Janet Gaynor who was in the first?
Yeah, Frederick March and, you know, then James Mason, Judy Garland, Streisand, Christopherson, and now this.
Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga, and Cooper directs. What did you think?
Well, I think it's a powerful movie. Overall, I think it's also a mixed bag. The first hour is pretty terrific. Cooper is a very good director. He also worked on the script. I think his decline, the character's decline in the movie, places, you know, a rock star on the skids, is more powerful and articulated than her rise to fame. That seems to be a little bit skimped. And after the first hour or so, you know, it's like you kind of know where this is going. It's an old chestnut, and it becomes a bit wearying. But they're both very good in the film, and it has, you know, some extraordinary stuff about the life of the performer, particularly on the fringes and on the low end. And it shouldn't be any surprise that she's a good actress, because, you know, when you think about it, there are a lot of singer performers who have or are very good actors, right? You know, Sinatra, Bette Midler, Willie Nelson, etc. They perform on stage.
Yeah, and particularly Gaga, whose sets are extremely elaborate. Peter, thank you so much. A Star is Born, Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga collaborating. That film comes out early in October. Peter Rayner joining us from the Toronto International Film Festival. Thank you so much for joining us for Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. Just a reminder that between now and the end of the year, a number of major releases are coming out, films looking to that Oscar qualifying window, and when so many Americans end up back in their local movie theaters. So don't miss a week of Film Week on KPCC.